May it please the Court.
Certainly.
This discipline case involves an attorney who was given an opportunity to take over a dying friend's very successful workers' comp practice with hundreds of clients and pending claims. When the friend, Michael Landoff, died, except for the estate being owed a portion of ongoing fees, all he needed to do was take care of the clients and cooperate with a young attorney who was also brought in to help finish the cases. They ended up not being able to work together, so 2 years later, in 2007, they split but agreed to split the fees and the case is ongoing. But we're just dealing here with the last 10 or so cases remaining 5 years later. By 2011, Mr. Raines had, the respondent, had created essentially a Ponzi-like mess of the proceeds in the remaining cases. That is, he always made sure that he got paid first, then he'd use client A's money to pay client B, and then didn't pay the co-counsel or the estate of Mr. Landoff at all. The result of these 11 counts of trust accounting violations and unpaid co-counsel for three or five years, and at least one unpaid client. The violation types are basically trust accounting violations and dishonesty. Several counts are that he owed the co-counsel, didn't pay it, but then also didn't hold the money as disputed funds. So one thing would have been if he'd held it, like he said he did, but instead it got spent as well, so he wasn't holding on to those disputed funds. Count two is just, and that's count 1, 4, 5, and 6. Count two is really just a commingling count by keeping personal funds in his account. And the third count is just a IRS levy on his trust account because of things like count two, where he left his own money in the trust account and then didn't take any action when the IRS levied his account, other than he says he called them and told them it was client money, which we know it wasn't all client money. It may have been at some particular time mostly client money. And then there are six or so counts of paying himself even before settling the client, or even before depositing the award, workers' comp award, into his trust account. A couple sample cases.
Well, how does he pay himself if he doesn't have the check in the bank account?
He just did. I mean, he paid himself from other people's money. So the memo on the check would refer to the case where he had not yet deposited the money. So that's why we say he paid himself in advance, because he was considering it that when he memoed the check that way. But in fact, it wasn't that client's money in any of these cases. So the Count 10 Burt Cox case, a workers' comp case, where he settled it in April of 2011, but paid himself in May of 2010. The client wasn't paid until 2013, after he had a new attorney and that attorney had reported the matter.
Did he have any mitigating factors, like a bad relationship or a drinking or depression or any of that kind of stuff?
You know, we didn't have any. There's really no evidence of it until at the, and he's had an extensive history getting to this point. But at the hearing in this case, scheduled for August of last year, he didn't appear and instead sent a letter saying that I checked myself in at Barnes, I guess, in St. Louis, saying that he was having panic attacks. So that's the closest I have to the answer of that, as to whether there's any evidence.
Did he ever give you any medical testimony or anything following that up, or did he submit to your own expert on those kind of issues?
The reports are in the record. But he did then later in the fall did appear back at the hearing before the panel with Mr. Downey, and they said they were ready to proceed. But he was suspended under Rule 5.23 when he made that declaration.
That he was not able to handle his cases because of the panic attack?
That he was not able to defend, actually.
As I understand it, the question here from Respondent's point of view is he doesn't deny there was any misconduct, but he does say it merits suspension, not disbarment.
Well, they deny a little some of the misconduct, but for the most part, that seems to be the argument.
This is a gentleman that we put on probation once, right? We had a suspension.
Yes.
We stayed a suspension already.
He's been.
Then we revoked his probation.
He's been exactly.
And then now we're here to resuspend him or disbar him. He's suggesting that the suspension is good enough.
Right. He is suspended because his probation was revoked after the earlier state suspension. He's also suspended under Rule 5.23C, which is where he declared himself unable to defend himself. And he's also suspended under the 5.245, the state tax. He failed to pay his state taxes and is suspended for that.
Has he paid his taxes? Has he restituted all the people that were damaged by his misconduct?
We're not even to the point of considering reinstatement, I hope, so I don't really know the answer.
No, but just it's important to know whether or not, as far as discipline, whether it's complete restitution of the victims of his unethical conduct.
Right. As far as the clients and the co-counsel and any money that was owed them, they have resolved it this year. They finally resolved it with some settlement of either. I'm not sure it ever made its way to litigation, but it was that part has been resolved. You know, whether we call that restitution or certainly not, it's certainly the kind of restitution where it was had to be forced to occur, but they worked it out. I don't know the answer on the question of whether the state taxes are now paid, or for that matter, the IRS, whether they've now been paid, whether the levy was enough for that bill.
Because the grounds for suspension if you don't pay your state taxes.
Yep.
So that's something.
Under that rule, yes, the grounds of suspension were failure to pay taxes and then this court's order under that rule. I think when we're analyzing which sanction is appropriate, we ought to think about what he knew when the misconduct occurred. We know that he always paid himself first on these 10 or so cases, and often before even making the deposit, as I mentioned. We know that he knew that the IRS believed he had personal funds in his trust account in 2011. We know that he knew that he had not paid the co-counsel, even though when he wrote checks to them in 2012, that he got insufficient funds checks on those checks where he tried to pay them. So he knew all this, he knew those things, that there was not enough money in his trust account, not the amount that even he claims he was holding for their benefit. And the panel found, of course, that he did violate not just Rule 115 of the trust accounting violation, but also 8.4C involving fraud, deceit, misrepresentation, and found that he had a knowledge and awareness of the substantial risk and acted with reckless disregard as to what would happen. We recommend a disbarment. It is knowing misconduct. Under 411 of the ABA sanction standards, that would be the appropriate sanction. It's the baseline sanction in Missouri, of course, for knowing misappropriation. But if you look at the ABA, even if you look at 412 and say it's suspension for negligent misuse of money, that then you still have to look at the aggravating and mitigating circumstances. Here you have, perhaps, according to the panel, personal problems and remorse. It doesn't seem remorseful when he still claims that he didn't know the money was gone, when in fact he had to have known because the IRS had taken some of it and he knew the bad checks. So in aggravation, we would be looking at selfishness. As I mentioned, he always made sure he got paid. Previous discipline, 3 admonitions in 2006 to 2008, a state suspension, it was revoked, probation revoked, the tax suspension, the incapacity suspension, multiple offenses, 10 offenses, and bad faith obstruction during our process. I think the admonitions should be considered as well. Rule 519E specifically allows consideration of admonitions in the next cases. And they are consensual by nature, not just by nature, by rule. 511 says they're consensual. In other words, the attorney doesn't just, it's not just our office that issues an admonition. The respondent has to accept it or can accept it by doing nothing as well. But it is an acceptance process because they can reject it. And they are at least evidence that the respondent has been warned of the misconduct. The ABA standards recommend consideration of admonitions. And frankly, from a policy perspective, how do we protect the public if we don't consider all of the misconduct or all of the conduct that
was
occurred in the past?
The conduct underlying the initial state suspension that then violated probation, that involved some similar issues regarding mixing funds? Or?
It did not, actually. It involved diligence, communication, and the failure to cooperate with the investigation. So it wasn't specific to trust accounting. And in fact, we didn't have a trust accounting condition in the probation conditions because we had not addressed that. Mm-hmm. We might have found it a few months earlier, although it was soon after he was placed on probation that the reports started coming in and we conducted the audit.
When you do training of people, do you train them on the nobility of the profession or that it is a profession and not necessarily a business where you get rich off other people's misery? Do you have a training program of values or moral anything like that?
Sure. I mean, I hope so. I mean, we probably do more mechanics because a lot of our issues, when we're dealing with most of the people, we're trying to deal with practical skills and office management and things like that. I mean, and just from in our position, we might be construed as too preachy if we just did the points you're making. I agree. I hope we do that. But often we try to bring in practitioners other than us to do those particular lessons. But they're important, but so are the practical skills. So often we focus on those when we're doing the teaching. The bar has lots of great programs that do involve professionalism training.
Because the other, you should say something about lucre. We've taken lucre out of it. You know, lucre is not in our bar admissions anymore. But the idea that you're alleging or proving that he stole from his clients and his whole purpose was to make money which is all good, but still, there's a higher purpose to our profession.
I hope so. I hope we try to do that.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Michael Downey for the respondent, Radford. He actually goes by Skip Raines. I'm actually going to start, Judge, where you ended, talking about morals in the profession. This is a case where a lawyer who had no ethics problems at all from 1989, his date of admission, until 2006, stepped in to try to help a friend who was dying of cancer and took over about 400 workers' compensation cases. And that actually, I appreciate opposing counsel starting there. That really is the start of the problems. He did receive two admonitions. The uncontroverted testimony on those admonitions is that they largely arose because the widow of the deceased lawyer withheld mail from him, so he didn't know that there were complaints arising from the deceased lawyer's cases that he had taken over. So he did take the two admonitions there. Subsequently, the 400 cases continued to snowball, and he reached the point where he was not able to manage things properly. I think it's important to note in Mr. Phillips' argument, it was sort of referenced, virtually all of the problems that really came to light here occurred in 2010 and 2011. He was suspended in 2012 for a portion of that conduct, and the informant actually states that there was a pattern of problems. The pattern of problems, I think the informant has correctly stated, they found part of the problems, they didn't find all of them. One of sort of the odd anomalies here is that Mr. Raines' trust account was not set up properly as a trust account. There was testimony this was inadvertent. He called the bank, asked them to set up an account, and they set it up incorrectly, but there were no notices given. So certainly one of the things that I think is a mitigating factor here, I would argue is not an aggravating factor, is he has prior discipline, but it really all stems from one situation. It was a problem where he effectively became overwhelmed by this practice and trying to help a friend, as you had said, trying to do something good for the profession and for the clients. and frankly just became overwhelmed.
And does that explain why he took money, he took his fees before he paid the clients or before the checks came in?
And actually, I'm glad you took me there. That's frankly the second point I want to raise. I think there's actually three different pools of money here that should be considered. There's the money that Mr. Raines took as his fees. There was the money that he paid to the clients and third parties, and I'm going to group those together. And then there was the money going to these co-counsel, to a lawyer named Ryan Cox, not to be confused with a client named Bertrand Cox, and also to Michael Londoff's widow. The money that he took as fees, he generally took after the case was settled. He had a couple of instances where he didn't deposit the checks properly, and so he ended up taking money out when he had the check, but he hadn't deposited the check. The Berthold Cox situation is a little bit different. I frankly, there's not clear testimony, and I don't know exactly why he took that settlement before the case was even settled, although that is what happened. Most of the cases, the clients were paid promptly as well. And in fact, there was a question asked of Kelly Dillon, as you probably know, is the paralegal for the OCDC. She was asked if there was evidence that Mr. Raines had ever taken more than he was entitled to, and she said, no, we don't have that evidence. So I think it really was a situation where he was taking his fees, he was generally paying the clients, and then this issue arose with what to do with the money going to the Londoff Trust and to Ryan Cox. That money was clearly supposed to be held. And frankly, because he didn't manage his trust account well, it was not properly preserved, and we admit that. But he was holding the money for Ryan Cox, as he has also testified, it was uncontroverted, as Ryan Cox was also holding money for him.
Does he now have an office manager?
Originally, when Michael Londoff died, Michael Londoff's office manager was his wife, then his widow. And Ryan Cox, who was a second-year attorney, and Mr. Raines, who was about a 17-year attorney, effectively were thrown into a partnership with...
What's he doing now? Does he have a manager or someone, a financial manager or a bookkeeper?
Mr. Cox or Mr. Raines?
Your client.
Mr. Raines has not practiced since 2012.
Okay.
And frankly, that's another issue that we have raised is he has not practiced. He actually was suspended in 2014. And one of the things we've argued is it would be appropriate to at least give him credit for time served. And just to clarify, we've asked for two different things. We think this is a suspension case where a long suspension would be suitable. Alternatively, we said, if you do believe the disbarment is appropriate, we ask that you at least give the one-year credit because he wasn't able to seek readmission because he had this case pending. And admittedly, that is not something Missouri has done. We cite case law from other jurisdictions in our briefs. There are some jurisdictions that do that regularly, but at least
Has his health improved since he went to Barnes Hospital?
His health is okay. You know, this has not been an easy time for him in many levels. Now that having been said, as was indicated, he did not try to bring in medical testimony. We do talk about some of the mental issues in our brief very briefly. I don't see it as a huge mitigating factor, but it's certainly something that happened there. So
tell us again why you think it's a suspension and not a disbarment case.
I think the key issue, and to compare this with the cases that we cited, the Eller case, the Ferris case, which this court recently decided, these were cases where the lawyer took money that wasn't theirs. And it was deliberately done. In the case of Ferris, he had $66,000 for one client, $30,000 for another in his trust account, and the testimony was clear that he took that money and put it in his operating account and spent it. In this case, there's no testimony that Mr. Raines ever took more than what he should have received on settlements if he had managed the checks properly. And I realize that last condition is why we're in a suspension case. He didn't necessarily manage the checks properly, but he never took more than his share of the fee. And he attempted to hold the other 65% in the account for the Londoff Trust and for Ryan Cox.
What is the basis if you're proposing then that there was no dishonesty, misappropriation of funds, but the DHP found that he had 9 violations of 4-8.4C for dishonesty, fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation?
Judge, I would love to understand in trust accounts how the 8.4C violations come up. It seems to me like they really do follow a mishandling of funds. There was misappropriation here. There were funds that he used that he wasn't supposed to use. The most notable instance was that I may have the date wrong, but I believe it was March of 2013, he made a unilateral effort to pay a bunch of money to try to settle his dispute with Ryan Cox. In doing so, he drew upon his second or new trust account, which was properly set up, and drew upon funds known as the Peaceful Settlement, clearly misappropriated those funds and paid them out to the Ryan Cox and the Londoff widow. That was misappropriation. What I would draw the line on there is I don't think, frankly, there was any fraud or deceit, and I don't think there was a deliberate intent of taking money. He was trying to resolve something. He was holding money in his other trust account for them and apparently wrote the check from the wrong account.
He had sufficient money to cover that, but he did it out of the wrong account, you're saying?
I think, actually, Judge, the answer to that is no. Okay. And I think the reason was because he had paid himself and paid clients from settlements that he hadn't deposited the checks. So, again,
I understand that you think
there's lots of paradox.
That you think that's a reasonable inference from the evidence, but isn't the inference that the administrative hearing panel brought also equally valid or reasonable, that he was just taking this when he wanted to? I mean, you start paying yourself first with money that isn't even out of that case. I mean, isn't dishonest motive a fair thing for them to assume in light of how often this occurred?
Judge, the testimony from Kelly Dillon was that there was not evidence of dishonest motive. I frankly believe that no. I think that this is someone who, if you looked at his normal course, and in every instance, I think, except the Berthold Cox case, he received the money, he promptly paid the client, he took his 35% of the fee, and he held the rest. Now, there were two cases where he didn't deposit the check, but if you took that amount and presumed that was what was going to be received, he took his 35% and paid the client, which is why he then misappropriated money that was supposed to have been set aside for the Londoff Trust. I mean, this is not a guy who ever said, I'm going to take 40 or 50 or 60 or 70%. He always took his 35%.
He always took the part, but he took it prematurely or for the wrong account on occasion?
That is correct.
Okay. Well, why isn't it also an inference that he took his fee and he took Cox's fee? He took the co-counsel's fee, or he took the Londoff Trust's share of the fee?
There was actually testimony in two of the cases, which were Carroll and Lodes or Lotus, that actually he prepared. Originally, it looked like he and Ryan Cox were going to work out a deal where they said, pay 35% to the Londoff Trust and you keep the other 65%. And when he indicated he was going to do that on the Carroll and Lotus cases, Mrs. Londoff came back and said, oh no, you need to pay Ryan Cox out of these settlements as well. And the testimony was that he then only took the 35% that was the undisputed amount and left the remaining funds in the account for Mr. Cox.
Well, but they didn't stay in the account. That's the problem. I mean, he left them in there until he spent them on something else.
Yes. And Judge, again, this is a case where we're conceding that he deserves a long suspension or disbarment. This is not a case where there'd be no way I could argue that everything was done properly here.
But even with disbarment, he can reapply after a certain number of years.
Yes. And frankly, I think one of the real things that we talk about in our brief is, if you look at the real differences between a suspension and disbarment in Missouri, there's obviously the stigma. The punishment of disbarment is the most serious punishment that can be imposed, and I don't mean to discount that. It's obviously a very serious message and punishment. Beyond that, it's really a question of how quickly can a lawyer get back in, and what do they need to do? And the most significant difference is that for a lawyer to be admitted after disbarment, you have to take the bar exam, and you have to wait 5 years. And what we've said is, really, there's nothing in Mr. Raines' case that indicates he needs to take the bar exam again. His violations were all ethics-related, money-handling-related, which would be handled by the MPRE that he'd have to take in either case. And then the question is, how long should he be out? And we feel that a long suspension, a 2 or 3 year suspension, would satisfy that. Or alternatively, a disbarment that could be shortened and reflect that he, in fact, has been without license since February of 2014. And let me say again, this is not a case where we don't feel that there was serious misconduct. I don't stand before you very often and say, you should suspend my client or disbar him, and just don't disbar him for 5 years. But this is a case where I think if you look at the testimony, there was no evidence, and Kelly Dillon admitted this, it's cited in our brief, and I can give you the page of the record. She indicated there was no evidence that he ever took more money than he was entitled to if things had gone properly. Now, of course, the problem was things didn't go properly. Just very quickly also, Judge Teitelman, you've asked about mitigating factors. We do cite a number of them. I think, frankly, that one of the things that I think is really, I don't want to have lost here, is that he did step in and try to help a dying friend. The circumstances were very rushed. He ended up becoming partners with Ryan Cox, basically, when Michael Londoff's condition got worse, and they said, we want you two to buy the practice.
He stepped in to help a friend, but Londoff, that seemed like a very, very big practice. I mean, I recall there were, the back page of the Yellow Pages was that's a very prosperous practice. It was stepping up a friend, but also some financial interest in getting involved in that.
Yes, and I think it's a little bit like trying to ski down the Black Slopes when you haven't skied before. He quickly found that things were moving much too quickly and the trees were coming at him a lot faster and harder than he ever expected.
Are there any experts? I mean, for example, if someone was asked to merge with another company, or someone comes in and does due diligence. I mean, I took over Hannibal Legal Services. I did the due diligence before I ever touched the thing.
Judge, there was absolutely no due diligence here. It was a friend saying, hey, I've got a cancer diagnosis, can you help? And then 4 months later, the friend's family coming back, and actually I think it was the friend calling back to the hospital bed and saying, I want you to buy my practice for $1 million. You and Ryan Cox are now going to be partners. And again, Ryan Cox was a second-year lawyer who had really never done any workers' comp, which left Skip Raines with about 400 workers' comp cases that clearly, you know, as I said, that the novice skier on the Black Slopes, he was not prepared to handle. Just real quickly also, and just so you want, I mentioned it before, but the testimony from Kelly Dillon's on page 261 of the record that there was no evidence he had taken more than he was entitled to. We talked about the disclosure of information. Mr. Raines, as indicated, was candid, and we said sort of as candid as he could be. There clearly were problems early on. There are letters in the file related to his character and the reputation. And I really think, frankly, the last thing to mention is that really all of the conduct here does arise from a single set of incidents. I know that obviously you look to prior discipline. I think it's appropriate to consider admonitions. We're not contesting that. I do think, though, that if you look, this was an intra-firm dispute that spilled over and had ramifications as to his license. And it was mentioned that things weren't settled until 2015. The only thing that had not been settled as of January 2015 was the dispute with Ryan Cox. Judge Teitelman asked earlier about restitution. As far as I know, all the taxes were paid relatively promptly. All of the clients, as indicated, received their money relatively quickly, with the exception of Berthold Cox. And so there was complete restitution and payments to everyone entitled to money. Seeing no further questions, then I have less than a minute. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Phillips, can you address the idea that raised by opposing counsel that some other states follow, that where you've been interim suspended, that you get credit for that period of time if you're disbarred?
Sure. I don't know why we would do it, and why I can't think of a reason to do it in this case. I mean, if you look at a progressive discipline scheme, like, and I think the court does, he's been twice suspended. And he is currently suspended.
What is our policy on prior discipline served? Do we have a policy? Or is he DC on this?
I can't think of a case when the court has done that.
Normally, if suspensions are no longer than 3 years, if you disbar, you normally don't have, you're not allowed to reapply to reinstate your license for 5 years.
Right.
He says some other states say if you've been suspended for a lengthy period related to the same conduct before the disbarment takes effect, they shorten the period to take account for part of that suspension where it's dealing with the same issue.
Right.
Because you've already not been practicing
sure,
for that period.
Can you
address whether, I'm not sure about his progressive discipline has to do with that policy question of,
well,
should you consider prior suspension on that particular misconduct that led to disbarment in deciding how long you're disbarred, you're prohibited from reapplying for?
I still think it comes down to three things. One is, I think that if you've been suspended twice, disbarment's the appropriate
right.
sanction.
Okay.
That his refusal to work with us and or with respond at all when he was on probation establishes something about his appreciation for the court's authority to regulate him. And that's a problem. I think the selfish behavior takes us out of the mercy business. I mean, we still have a job to protect the public in our system. And we still have a job to protect the integrity of the profession. And that's what we have to do sometimes, even though we may feel like, well, 3 years is enough. for this particular lawyer.
Well, that's not the question, though. It's should you get credit for, and maybe your answer is no, but I don't, those are all reasons why you think there should be disbarment instead of suspension, and I understand those well. But his question is, in figuring out disbarment, if he was suspended for the conduct that led to his disbarment already, so hasn't been practicing, is there a policy reason that we should or should not consider that time he's already been barred from practicing and deciding when he can apply for reinstatement? He may not get it ever, but that he inability to apply.
And I understand it, and I don't agree.
Okay.
At all. But and I think the policy argument goes back to the idea that sometimes public protection, the integrity of the profession, says that we ought to do whatever is the maximum sanction when you have a history like this and there's this much harm that occurs to various people.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Case will be submitted.